Hello, and thanks for choosing this Analyst Insight podcast from the Information Security Forum. Hello to our regular listeners. It's a group that is growing by the week, but you know what? It struck me we should come up with a name for that group. Lady Gaga has her Little Monsters. Taylor Swift has Swifties. Ed Sheeran has the gloriously named Cheerios. But what would it be for dedicated fans of chat about InfoSec? Infonauts? ISFers? SOGers, because of the ISF's standard good practice, SOGP, but I'm sure we can do better than that. If any of our listeners have thoughts, please do let us know, send us your suggestions. And thanks too for the continued support. Tell your friends, tell your colleagues. We do want these podcasts to reflect what listeners are curious about. So if there's a subject you want us to delve into, by all means, let us know. mark.ward@securityforum.org is the email address. And there are contact details on the Audio Boom page where every episode is available. Go nuts. Listen to five in a row. Who wouldn't want to do that? This episode is a companion piece to the work Paul Watts is doing on leadership and returns to the topic of the BISO, the Business Information Security Officer. We're considering it from another angle by looking at the state of recruitment and seeing what that reveals about the job, its future, and InfoSec in general. My name's Mark Ward, and I've been recruited a few different ways. Applied for jobs and been in the right place at the right time. I was even headhunted once, but not because I was talented, but because the guy who headhunted me wanted to really annoy a rival magazine editor, and I was a mere pawn in his bigger plan. We've got someone here, Ross Tanner, an associate director at recruitment firm LaFosse, that knows a great deal more about that recruitment market. Hello, Ross.
Hi, Mark. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Just to continue that theme, who's your favourite musician? Do they have a name for their fans?
Do you know, you were saying that and I was thinking of the names that people had for me and I was thinking it's probably not going to be useful for this podcast or for any fan base. Yeah, Swifties you can't seem to move for these days. They're really everywhere, it seems. So it's hard to think of anything past that right now.
Okay. Are you a fan of Taylor Swift?
Paul's a Swiftie. I know that much.
We're all Swifties in spirit, I think. Also here, you're mentioning his podcast regular, Paul Watts, who's also author of the series on leadership. Hello, Paul. How about you? Do you have any collective names for your colleagues that you'd want to share? Keep it clean.
Well, there's only one word that comes to mind for somebody who would enjoy listening to a number of these back to back, and that's got to be the Insomniacs.
Ooh. Definitely. It's a good start.
As for me being a Swiftie, I will never, never, never. Sorry, that's terrible.
Oh, God.
Wow. Was that a Taylor Swift joke? I know nothing
about
Taylor Swift.
That was a Taylor Swift joke.
Shake It Off. Boom. Is that another
Taylor Swift song? Oh, well done.
Woo.
There we go.
If my kids listened to Taylor Swift, they would be impressed, but they don't. But back in the day, I was a Numanoid. Gary Numan, anybody remember him? No, obviously not.
Charles?
Dead Air. Yeah, well, a few other things. Our Friends Electric and things like that.
It was very much in the back in the synth days of the 80s, if memory serves.
Yeah, very early synth music.
Yeah. Ross is too young to understand it. Yeah.
Slightly before my time.
He's more into Paw Patrol and...
Bluey.
Yeah, we've skipped a couple of years in the middle there, but yeah.
Look, I was doing you a favour there. You should thank me for taking many years off your age. Yeah.
Definitely. Well, to haul this back to the topic that we're supposed to be talking about, Paul, I don't know if you could give us a quick update on the leadership series. I think there's been a few papers now, one on strategy, one on the BISO, one looking at the future of the role in general. So, but yeah, what's next? I don't know if you've got plans for the next couple of papers or, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. There's a lot to unpack. So the series has meandered in a few directions. So we started with a paper that was exploring the relationship between security risk management and business value, which is something that we are often accused of forgetting. We're wholly obsessed with seeing the business through a risk register. And the paper was exploring kind of putting ourselves above that and recognizing that business outcome is an equation with multiple variables of which we influence maybe only a few. And just to look at the bigger picture, so that was the first paper, went down reasonably well. The second paper was looking at an emergent role in the security leadership space, and that is the role of the Business Information Security Officer, which is a bit of a carry-on from the first paper where we recognised that we need to take a bit of a business-first, security-second approach. So we need to be looking at the tradecraft of security to help solve and address business challenges or to allow the organisation to move in a particular direction whilst balancing the potential risk with the potential reward. And that role is becoming hugely popular. So a bit of observational research there. And then the third paper is looking at the future of the security leader, remembering that we try and speak with inclusive language when we talk about security leaders. CISOs is just one title. And we explore five predictions for the future of the security leader role. What happens if we do nothing? What could happen if we do something? And we did a virtual roundtable just after Easter, actually exploring some of those predictions. Interestingly, I think we were all in violent agreement, but the one that was massively divisive and continues to be divisive is whether the security leader should be on the board or not. There doesn't seem to be a good or bad answer. It really depends who you are, what you are, or why you are. The future papers, interesting. It looks like we're likely to do a paper which brings the security leader's characteristics down to a boilerplate. One of the challenges that we have is ambiguity with the role and the management of expectations as to what a security leader should or should not do. So I'm going to be exploring that a little bit. And Ross, just to put you on notice, I'll definitely be dipping into your knowledge to help pull that together.
Okay.
That's kind of where we're at.
Cool. Thank you. Ross, I don't know if that is ambiguity cause you problems, that it's hard to standardize what people you're looking for.
It definitely is. If CISO recruitment in particular was easy as CFO recruitment, I'd have more hair than I currently do. but I'm sure we'll get onto the topic. They come in various shapes and sizes. I think the industry tries to put quite a lot of time defining that box and putting people into one box or another and trying to classify one box as good and or not. I think the reality is that it varies a lot from organization to organization, and the risk profile of organizations at the time as well heavily dictates that. So it keeps me on my toes for sure.
So in some respects, then a CISO an organization needed 3 years ago would not be the CISO they would need now. Is that? I mean, does it change that quickly? Perhaps.
It really can, and it can be often about the maturity of the organization and how they operate. You know, the state of your organization and the skill sets that you may need right now, particularly if you're a hyper growth organization. We see, you know, series funded businesses growing rapidly, going through this a lot. The skill set you need now as a 1,000 person organization. And the person is not the same as you need at 5,000 people. And do you have the foresight to hire the leader you need for the future, or are you hiring the person that you need now and everything?
All right, that's interesting, Paul. I know you've sounds something of a slight, but you've moved around quite a bit. But have you seen that sort of, I guess, different stages in your life, in your career, then? Very different roles, I guess, very different things you were asked to do at those places.
100%. I mean, if you can bring a cross section of security leaders and put them in a role and in a room, and they will all have a different perception of what it is that they need to do versus expected to do, what their prime motivators are, what their business priorities are, and what skills they need to draw upon to be effective in role. I mean, when I did the research for the third paper, I stopped counting at 12 different types of security leader, everything from the transformation to the post-breach security leader to the technical security leader and everything in between. It's just such a diversity. I think the other issue, and Ross, you've probably got some thoughts on this as well, where you either get a regulatory pressure or a post-incident pressure, and the business basically mandates to get a CISO, any CISO, and they go to the market or they talk to their TA teams and they say, find a CISO. And you say, well, what do you want them to do? You figure it out. And you either end up with a shopping list of qualifications, which is absolutely useless, or a really soft, ambiguous role, which just absolutely inflates the risk of the wrong person being appointed. Yeah. I mean, what are your experiences there, Ross?
100%. I think pre-COVID, that was a much more common norm. The willingness to find anyone, get them in the role, we're happy to look outside, was more common. In this current global climate, risk-averse hiring has skyrocketed. It is horses for courses. Organizations want, if you are a tech firm, you have to have come from a tech firm with the same background. If you're banking, it's banking. It just speaks to the climate. It's risk-averse hiring.
All right. Okay. And are there, because obviously there's a lot of talk about the skill shortages, but is it a different kind of skill shortage for those slightly more senior roles? Because I guess it's not, you're not talking about technical skills here. You're talking about, we've talked about this, Paul, it's just sometimes they're really hard to acquire skills because they're on the job training generally, or experience training.
The problem is that, and I mean a disrespect for this because I love my peer group, but you can bring a security leader into an organization that is the absolute world-class expert at risk management frameworks or ISMS orchestration or tech transformation, security architecture. But if they can't fit the culture of the organization, if they can't relate to what the business is trying to do, and they can't strike a decent relationship with the business, they're just only ever going to contradict and cause friction. And if you can't get past that, it really diminishes the returns that you have. And managing the expectation of what you're there to do, the worst thing you can do in this day and age is go into an organization with your cookie cutter approach to what you're going to do as a security leader, because you're going to immediately put yourself at conflict. So you're drawing down on a real breadth of skills and knowledge to be effective in role. And, you know, it's why we are much more cautious and diligent as security leaders when we court a potential future employer. You know, we want to know what their motivations are, what the culture is, what the budget looks like, and all of these questions. Whereas before it'd be, well, how hard could it be? I'll take a punt on that. I quite like the idea of working for that organization. And then 8 months later, I'm knocking on the door going, Ross, can I have another one? You know, that's not helpful to employee and it's not helpful to employer.
Yeah, but I don't know, Ross, I guess it's hard to put please fit in with our culture in a job ad, but do you have to get a sense of that in the organization? I guess there's some commonalities across organizations, but equally I know there's a lot of organizations which are very odd as well, places to work.
Yeah, it is. It's tough. You know, by the time someone is speaking to myself or our organization about bringing someone in, you know, they're on the front foot with the sell, and it's, why should you join our company? And this is the journey we're going on. Please find us our superstar. And I'll, you know, use the example here. I placed Paul in a CISO job that he probably won't thank me for. And on the surface of what we were talking about, phenomenal transformation journey, career making, wonderful signpost the whole way. And it definitely resulted in Paul having less hair than he currently does. Because it turned out that culturally in the organization was going through such a challenge that Paul found himself in the center of, that could we have known that prior, it would have been very, very difficult.
That said, massive learning experience as well. So you've kind of got to roll with it as well. If it was easy, we'd all be doing it, right? And it's not easy, and we're not all doing it. So that has to tell you something. But you very early on, you get a feel for whether this is going to work out or whether it isn't. And more often than not, for reasons that we've tried to unpick in some of the leadership papers, and Ross has been getting his head around for many years in his line of work, we have low levels of retention of CISO roles. You know, they generally don't outlast a business strategy cycle, which means every time you're changing the security leader, you're resetting the security strategy in the middle of a business transformation strategy or a business strategic cycle. That's just not compatible with life. It just creates a problem. So the question is, how do you get a security leader to survive longer in an organization? Requires a good management of expectations, a clear understanding of what you should or should not be doing, but also recognizing that that's an iterative process. You have to keep going back, going, are we doing the same things? What's changed? What do I need to do differently?
Yeah.
Are we still on the same plane? If you're not doing that and you just carry on off into the distance, you're only going to last 18 months to 2 years at least.
Yeah. And you're also, at best, as you said there, Paul, you know, you're retrofitting security. You're not talking about security by design. You are playing catch up to someone else's right or wrong decision that probably isn't the exact way you would like to do it, but you're dealing with what's in front of you. So you're already on the back foot as a CISO coming into a scenario like that, regardless of how polished your CV is or not.
Yeah. I guess there's other skills there that, again, you're not going to get any training in, but you're just going to have to feel your way through it. But is the B so a kind of marker of some of that change? Because I guess the B for business implies there is a change. It's not, but I don't know if you've, when was the first time you saw that BISO being advertised? Was it a while ago?
I did some research before this call through my old inboxes. 2014 was the first BISO spec.
10 years ago. Whoa.
2014 was the first BISO spec I found on the, in the archives of our system.
Wow.
And don't get me wrong, they were fewer and further between then than they are now.
Yeah.
2014.
Gosh. And was that, I don't know if you can share any details about that, but was that in the tech space at all? Or
it was a CISO reported reporting line in a it was an insurance firm.
All right.
I think they are on the rise, but I think it's an evolution of what you would have seen more commonly in technology and that sort of business relationship management role, which has been around for a few years.
Okay.
I just think it comes in a lot more shapes and sizes than a BRM does.
Yeah. But it, is it, again, one of those things that is kind of bespoke as well, though? Because I guess, you know, to your point, Paul, about transformation and retention, then are those BISOs usually recruited for a particular phase of an organization's development, maturity, transformation?
Well, it's interesting what Ross says, that first one being back to 2014, in that our research actually showed exactly the same, that FS was probably one of the early adopters of this. I think what happened here was a couple of things. I think the first was a recognition that technology had moved from business supporting to business enabling to basically being the business. And we have gone on a similar journey to information technology teams, where in the old days they were order takers, they kind of sat agnostic from the business. It was, I want something, we supplied that. No, that's wrong. Supply me another thing, supply me another thing. But very quickly, they recognized the value of, I've got a problem, help me solve the problem, drove a different level of engagement with IT and the business. And what's happening now with cybersecurity and risk management is we used to be regulators, auditors, order takers, but now the realization is tech drives our company. Tech is intrinsically linked to business outcome. How do you help us to be successful? And that's causing security and risk management teams to repurpose. When you look at the operating model, we traditionally still have somebody at the top, the combination of responsibility and accountability being that security leader, and then a security team that kind of sits underneath that. And what we're realizing is that the partnering models that we saw in IT now work quite well in security. But the best way to do that is to fragment and decentralize the operating model. The final thing I would say is the BISOs are there to stop the CISOs bursting into flames, because it is physically impossible for a security leader to be across the entirety of their organization at any point in time, all seeing, all knowing. It's just not possible. If you're in a multinational organization, for example, it just cannot be done. So the operating model's being fragmented to give that visibility, but also bring security closer to the business. And that's kind of where the BISOs and those kind of business partnering BRM roles have grown in popularity. And long may it continue, to be honest, because organizations that have adopted it have seen real value. The security leader is able to repurpose themselves, stop worrying about putting out fires, and start thinking about business alignment, strategic alignment, working with the business leaders in an advisory capacity. It's a total game changer for security leadership, in my opinion.
Yeah, because I think the first, well, I did a paper on next-gen CISOs a few years ago, and BISOs was starting to sort of emerge in that. But the work I did on governance a couple of years ago, there were a few companies who cultivated BISOs internally, and there was about five or six in orbit around the CISO. I don't know if, Ross, have you seen that organizations recruit more than one when it comes to BISOs, whether they are the sort of, they need a cohort, because as Paul says, it's about relieving the pressure on the security leaders.
I think it depends on both size and maturity. Okay. It's definitely a indication of maturity. You know, you starting out in your security journey, you're going to have more likely than not some basic fundamental of design, build, run. And then your phase two, as you start to build more advanced capabilities in certain areas, threat investigations, whatever it may be, you likely would see a BISO organization appearing at that point. Mm-hmm. I think to the size question, the bigger organizations, you will see directors of business information security within which they have a team of BISOs aligned to whatever it may be, country, region, functionality. But it really does depend on, back to Paul's point about the approach you're taking. Are you in a centralized function deploying them out? Are they embedded in the business returning back? Are you drawing down from a shared service and you're almost a demand manager? Like, they come in shapes and sizes that vary from case to case.
Right. And do you get... do you help an organization realize what it wants as well? I would imagine that they come to you and say, we think we need this. And I guess there's some sort of back and forth with you about actually, what do you need? Actually, I think you need this rather than that.
An awful lot. You know, Paul and I have had conversations in the past from, you know, how do we build central recharge models? What's the approach? How do we take the outcome we're looking for and build a skills framework that meets that demand? That's kind of where we try and pigeonhole ourselves above the norm. Of, you know, filling jobs, and much more into the how do you create a model that fits not only for your organization, but it's attractive to people in the market.
All right.
And I think that kind of ties back to something that I think is fundamentally wrong in the tech recruitment industry in general. And I'm hanging this on the hiring managers rather than the recruiters, Ross. And I'm sure you have something to say on this as well. We've got to get past the role specification that says you need 5 years of this, 2 years of this, 8 years of this, 6 years of this, 12 years of this, and this and this and this and this and this. And actually repurpose role specifications to say, we're looking for a person who can help us deliver this outcome in this culture and within this environment. Because the problem that we have in tech, a very broad problem that we have in tech and security, is we're still not as inclusive as we need to be. And the approach we have to talent acquisition, I'm certain, is compounding that problem. But it's also impeding and impinging people who actually have the soft characteristics to be very, very successful in security leadership, but are caught in that catch-22 because they haven't got 10 years security leadership experience, which is, you know, the prerequisite that they need to get onto the leadership ladder. I mean, something is fundamentally broken there. So this is a massive call to arms to say, we need to look at the way we are specifying and sourcing our talent, because it is very, very stymied and very, very broken, basically.
100%. I've been saying for years, we don't have a skills gap or shortage. We have and we're back to risk again. We have a problem with regards to risk averse hiring, and believing that our problem is unique and that 10 out of 10 requirements need to be hit. There is a world of network engineers, infrastructure engineers with a baseline knowledge of the vast majority of what's needed here that could very easily translate into a security role should the business be willing to take a punt and put in place a training plan and development to get there. Just sadly, to Paul's point, we are tied into this glove and hand approach to hiring that's stopping us from capitalizing on the talent that's already in the industry.
Yeah, and we've seen that in a couple of interviews we've done for the podcast, that some, forward-thinking organizations have gone outside the tent, shall we say, and you know, looked at very different graduates and with different subjects, not technical subjects often, had real success because those people are great at saying, well, why are you doing it like that?
Yeah.
And they do already have that outside perspective and can really help that organization change, which is a part of what, you know, what it should be about.
We have a train and deploy business, which is, it's downstairs, it's classrooms with engineering trainers, and we create new people from scratch because of exactly that problem. And what we're building is, rather than security specialists, we are creating technologists who can code, script, build, who understand architectures, technologies, how to work in a business. That skill set, and when they're then deployed in security, is eating up ground rapidly, because the challenge we have in security isn't people who know security people principles. It's an understanding of technology that's the challenge. And now let's apply the security principles on top.
I think we need to smash the stereotype a little bit here. I'll just put this out here as well. This came up a lot when we were looking at the third paper as well. We talk about security now being a real creator or enabler of business value. It's essentially become a business managerial role. Now, I'm not going to get into the conversation about whether a security leader should or should not be on the board. I have a view. It's in the paper. Read the paper. And let's talk about whether you agree or disagree. But what I'm getting at here is, do we really need security leaders to be technical? I think we're past that now. Actually, when you think of the level and depth of engagement they need with the mechanics of the business and the stakeholders of the business themselves, why can't we have strong business leaders being security leaders? Actually, the technicalities of doing the role need to be somewhere else. You know, I'm a geek at heart. I love my technology. But very early on in my security leadership career, I realized I didn't have time to be doing all of that. I had to recruit people who were cleverer at me to do it for me so I could spend time with my business. Do you think, and again, Ross, are you seeing this when you're talking to organizations? Is that stereotype damaging the efficacy and the range of people we have doing security leadership?
I think it depends on the organization and what they mean by a technical CISO. You know, if we're talking about some organizations say this is they think if I hire a technical CISO, that means they can do more, I can hire less people, less cost, problem solved. I think a technical aptitude, however, I think is a different thing. And I'll give you an example. There's a CISO I know who was a very well-regarded CISO from a big bank who joined a tech firm recently. And he said to me that he's never been on a steeper learning curve than he currently is. And he believes that he's a better CISO than he's ever been because he's not sat in risk committees talking about what you could do in security. He's building and designing security in a way that he never has been before. And that organization was willing to take the punt, but most organizations don't want the learning curve that that person's going through. They want the finished product now.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I remember talking to a couple of CISOs as well who were keen to stay in that technical role because they'd been in an organization for quite some time and were very familiar with it. And I kind of wanted to and felt that it was, I guess, the organization was best served by them keeping on doing that and not stepping out and becoming that diplomat, that cross-border conversationalist. But that, and that's why they set up the BISO cohort, because they realized, and which, again, is fairly forward-thinking, but if they're still the senior person, then that's who the board chats to, and they only get that tech lens, then maybe that isn't the best decision.
I'd say the one thing that I would say happens, though, is that regardless of the route that you see the two roles converge to, when you get to the top 1% of people at both routes, they converge back again. And the conversation with them is very rarely ever about security. It's people, processes, and tech, and a eloquence that you would see amongst other board members who very rarely are ever talking about their functional area. They're talking about the business. But that's a small group.
Yeah, and I think it comes back to what we've said before, and lends itself to what the research has kind of called out, in that security leadership and the characteristics of what's more or less important is driven by the dynamics of the business. So, if you want the oven ready ISMS, then recruit a CISO that can deliver that and just get on with it. To Ross's point, and just JFDI, and don't tell me about the labor pain, show me the baby, and all of those other metaphors. But if it's about maintaining a balance that allows an organization to grow very, very quickly. So if you're a startup, just got your Series B funding, you've got 2 years to make a real dent, grow the market share, blah, 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 blah. It's about dynamic conversations about taking risks or not taking risks in flight. That requires a totally different set of characteristics and behaviors. I think what we're seeing now is a real dynamicism in the security leader role. We have to be highly adaptable and very, very different. But we also need to recognize, and this is where a lot of security leaders do set themselves up to burn out and fail, we don't have to be doing it all. Look at your operating model, recognize what your strengths are, and supplement and augment the areas where you're not as strong with people who can support you and take your team on the journey. You don't have to be an expert in everything.
Yeah, I think that's very good advice. But and it leads me to ask the question, Ross, whether you think BISOs will die out, whether the CISO... whether they're just a bit of a flash in the pan, and Paul's ideas about the future of the CISO role mean that it will come roaring back, and actually organizations will go, you know what, we need a C, not a B. Even though, like you say, at that point, that top point, they're doing the same kinds of things.
I don't think it will die out, no. In an ideal world, in the same way with technology, right? If technology was closer to the business, you wouldn't need a BRM. If security was closer to the business and your head of SecOps, head of AppSec, your head of all areas were closer to the business, you wouldn't need it. But the reality is that's often not the case. And I think this role, exactly as Paul said, allows the CISO to have someone pounding the streets in the way that he or she wishes they could but can't. And I think that they're not a threat to the CISO role in positioned right. They should facilitate and enable everyone else. It's just how they're positioned in orgs is often whether or not they're teed up for success in that way is a different kind of fish.
There's a real, I mean, we talk about the CISO role, security leader role, still being quite young, quite embryonic, but it's even more juvenile in the BISO space. I mean, again, you'll know more than me, Ross, but when I did the BISO research, I laid a number of propositions, job specifications down. You were seeing very, very junior roles paying a fairly low wage against MRP, all the way up to BISOs that were basically exec grade and commanding, decent six-figure salaries, certainly in the UK market. And it's really hard talking to BISOs, trying to navigate their way around the industry. They're having to do some really significant pivots, either in terms of lifestyle or compensation or whatever, to move laterally around. Do you think that will fix itself over time? How can we help mature the specification, maybe harmonize the MRP so it's more of a level playing field.
God, I wish you could say standardizing it would be that simple. In its worst case, I've seen BSOs hired, and I won't name the organization, but a managing director of a function within this financial services firm hired a BSO to put between himself and security to make sense of what was going on over there. I don't want to deal with the noise of this security machine. BSO, stand between me and that organization to deal with that, so I don't have to think about it. That is your worst end of the scale. The best end of your scale, as you've pointed out in one of your papers, Paul, is it's a facilitator of group strategy, making it relevant to organizational strategy and or function. Yep. Independent decision making, an empowered BSO that's making security relevant for a business. That is where ideally this comes out and is positioned.
Do you think as well that the ambiguity of role specifications is giving an additional problem? Sorry, let me give this a bit more context. I'm unfortunately going to dip my toe into the mire of the puddle that is artificial intelligence. So I talk to a lot of security leaders who are hiring managers, and they are having an absolute nightmare, even at stage one sift, trying to separate the genuine bona fide legitimized applications for roles against the dross that is synthetic and largely generated by AI. What are you seeing from your perspective, and what advice, if any, could you give to hiring managers who are trying to navigate the separate the wheat from the chaff, for want of a better expression? You know, AI is clearly presenting them with a challenge.
Are you referring to AI in people's applications or as part of their role?
AI as people's applications, although if you've got a view on the other one, then we'd be happy to hear that as well, Ross.
On both fronts. I think in the applications, there's still a failing and a laziness in how we're going about interview processing and assessing. And I think making sure that you're really thoroughly probing and challenging, and often in an open and clear way to organizations, you know, you can with individuals, I should say. I think if you present a situation where someone has to come forward with examples and reasoning, and we're, you know, probing in constructive ways, you can prep your first answer through AI, 100%. Yeah. But I think the follow up and probe and human aspects around it, you can't maneuver your way out of that interview. And I think that's the piece where we're not, as an industry, teeing ourselves up for success, all the people we're interviewing.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard some horror stories of, the sifting would have happened, and maybe we're on to a stage two interview, which is conducted over Teams, potentially in a worst case scenario with a camera off. And the interviewer will ask a question, and then there's a pause, and then an answer is recited, which when you sit back and think about it, it's an AI supported response.
Yeah.
When you then get that person face to face and you interview via the STAR method, they literally last 5 minutes. Now, you can say that actually those layers of defense mean that you can weed out the vast majority of the chances, with the occasional one or two getting through.
Yeah.
But if I look at that from a hiring manager perspective, where these security teams are running to stand still, if you've got to keep resetting your hiring cycle because you literally get to the last three in a shortlist and all three of them potentially aren't what they pertain to be in the early stages of interview, that can't be healthy for the hiring manager, and it can't be healthy for recruiters either.
No. And that's why my team here, there's 20 or so solely focusing on InfoSec, spend all of their time day in, day out, meeting people face to face. And it's understanding, talk me through your experience. Where's that happened? When you say we, was that we, the royal we, or you? And sort of pulling those examples apart. And you quickly start to see where the superstars were. And referrals is a huge one in particular.
Yeah. Yeah, my wife recently went through this because she had to find a new role, and as a friend of mine very perceptively said, she's the job. If you need someone with her skill set, she's a great networker, she's really smart, she's got a long history, very good contacts, all kinds of useful skills. If you need those skills, then she's the person, and she could fit in lots of different places. I mean, she happens to specialize in telecoms, but I guess that's what you're the person, you're looking for to get a sense of their shape and, you know, what shape you can fit them into when, you know, which organizations have the right hole for them to slot into.
Exactly that. And when we're doing, you know, bulk campaign hiring and we're talking to organizations about pragmatic hiring, you're interviewing someone, they are not right for BISO role X, but we have a governance, risk and compliance manager that's planned for 3 months down the line who this person will be far better suited for. And kind of seeing the skill set, as you've said there, and thinking about the wider, many overlapping roles that we have in our industry, and how does someone, you know, who's not a fit here, fit over here, you know, better fit?
Yeah, definitely. I guess, so just to sum up then, I think in terms of organizations thinking about hiring, but maybe hiring BISOs, is take some risks. Don't just do that cookie cutter, drop a list of things, you know, talk to those people, get involved and look outside tech as well. Anything else, Paul, Ross, last closing bit of advice?
I've just got one more question, if I may.
Sure.
Because I'd be interested in your opinion on this, Ross. So a lot of organizations are getting to the point that they recognize that they've, you know, tech has consumed their organizations and now they need to think about risk and reward, and they're looking to recruit their first security leaders and build their first security functions. What does the market look like in terms of VCSOs and interims versus permies at the moment? And what are the pros and cons of organizations essentially trying before they buy? Because I get it, but I just wonder what separates an organization from going down the virtual and interim route from going straight in and hiring a perm. What, just interested in your views on that.
Oh, we've got another hour. We can get stuck in. Interim is on the rise. I think that, however, is a economically driven decision. Interim trades well through downturns. Fact, people don't want to commit to large chief anything investments during downturns. So we've seen more interim CISO hiring in the last 24 months than we have done in the last 6 years. I think advisory hiring in the UK, the maturity for that market is on the rise. It's something we do quite a lot. And it was something that Mark said earlier around, you know, being able to make the investment into the right people. A lot of organizations don't have either the money and or the salary bandings to allow for a £500,000, £1 million CISO hire that in an ideal world they could or should get access to for the advice that they need. And so we do a reasonable amount of provisions to organizations where we're saying, well, why not hire that person on a one-day a month basis to provide you that oversight and coverage of what a top 1% advice looks like. And then hire the more junior person that you can afford, because that's where you are at your stage as a business, and combine the two to ultimately get to where you need to. I think it's a more common model in America that we see a lot. Europe, far less common. And in the UK, it's on the rise. So I think hopefully we can learn a little bit more about that model from our US counterparts and start to bring it a bit more centrally over here.
Yeah, interesting. Thank you. Thank you, Ross. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, everybody else, for listening. Tell your friends and make sure it's a regular part of maybe your dog walking regime, because certainly a lot of people seem to listen to these podcasts while they're walking their dogs. And you can now find ISO podcasts on all major podcast platforms. Look for us on Spotify, Apple as well, pretty much everywhere these days. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss an episode. The podcasts are also available at securityforum.org, where you can also learn much more about ISF research, tools, and guidance.